Today we're going to discuss a very interesting case, and this is probably going to take a series of podcasts to explain because there's so many caveats and interesting avenues to go down and pieces to this case. And it's about an Israeli company stealing technology from a private U.S. company with the help of federal agents and state agents in the state of New York. There's misappropriated funds from a university, there's stolen trade secrets, it's just a mess. But we're going to start unraveling this case. This ought to be all over the mainstream news. So my guest today will be Dr. John Nashio, and we're going to start explaining it, starting with his nonprofit organization, which is trying to help the companies involved in this case who had their technology stolen from them.
This is ANC Report with Ryan Dawson. We're here today talking with John Nashio, Dr. Nashio. He's the executive director of a charitable nonprofit group called the Institute for Complexity Management. And we have a very interesting case today to go through. Dr. Nashio, can you tell us a little bit about your organization and how it got started before we get into this case?
Sure, Ryan. One of the principal reasons that the Institute for Complexity Management, and we call that ICM, was established is to help ordinary people, ordinary Americans, fight the type of fraud, waste, and abuse by the government bureaucracy that is directly impacting their lives every day. For example, we get requests from small businesses claiming that they have been the victims of government corruption. We only have the resources to focus on a very small number of these cases that we get, where the actions by the government are especially egregious. All of our work is done pro bono. We try to maintain our independence, and we depend completely on charitable contributions, contributions from the public. We began our program of investigating government fraud, waste, and abuse when my own small company became the victim of government corruption. In my case, my little company, the Food and Drug Administration, actually plagiarized, took my private research, my doctoral dissertation work research that I had done at George Washington University, and they plagiarized it, and they took the patents and trade secrets that I had developed based on my dissertation to duplicate the products that we were already selling, in this case, to the food industry. They intentionally evaded the Constitution to put us out of business. This is when I started to talk with a lot of other people in business and in government and around the system and found out that my situation wasn't just an isolated incident. In fact, there are literally millions of Americans whose lives are being directly impacted by government corruption today as we speak on the radio.
What kind of interesting cases are you working on now with this?
Well, we've got a couple of really good cases that I think exemplify the way that corruption can really impact the life of every American. Over the past several months, we've engaged in two major investigations. The first involves a case where the U.S. Army misappropriated the technology of a small company that developed a special canteen for soldiers that allows them to safely drink water when they are under chemical, biological, and nuclear attack on the battlefield. In this case, the Army stole the small business's owner's technology. And when he dared to complain, the U.S. Army established a kangaroo court to basically declare themselves innocent. The case violates federal procurement law. It involves perjury by government officials and violations of the Constitution itself, the civil liberties of the gentleman involved, the owner of this small company. Now, the second case involves a small New Jersey-based company, and the company is called Demodulation. They came to us about 12 months ago complaining that they were the victims of widespread corruption involving the federal government, New York State public officials, and universities and companies operating throughout the state of New York. In this case, we found probable cause to believe that millions of dollars in taxpayer monies are being diverted away from programs that are intended to help small businesses.
Why is our government giving money to small businesses?
Well, I think that's really an excellent question, and I think that's at the heart of the demodulation case. Small businesses, as you know, and many of the people listening today, are really the cornerstone of the American economy. Many of us immediately think that most scientists and engineers are employed by big companies and the government. In fact, most of our best scientists and engineers are really employed by small businesses. Second, it is small businesses that create most of the new jobs in America. So it's not your large corporations like IBM, Corning Glassworks, or others, that the big, huge corporations that are producing the new jobs. It's little companies. Little companies like the two companies I've just mentioned earlier. Third, small business, not the government, or large corporations, do most of the innovation in this country. Most of the really, really good patents that drive innovation, things like your Apple phone and all of those changes, really come from small businesses who innovate and make change that later big corporations use to commercialize and sell for billions of dollars advanced technologies that we use all the time.
So are you saying in the case of demodulation that this grant money, because I believe it went to a school first and they misappropriated, but this money that should have been going to the small businesses like demodulation was being stolen?
Exactly right. What we found in the case of demodulation is evidence giving us probable cause to believe that millions of taxpayer dollars, millions, really intended for small business development to create the new businesses that innovate, create jobs, and do those sorts of things in New York State are really being misappropriated. And what they're being misappropriated to do is basically steal the technology developed, the innovative technologies developed by small companies like demodulation, and moving those technologies directly to large corporate interests and to subsidize their research and development rather than subsidizing small businesses to become successful. So you can see that what we're really doing is we're defeating the very purpose of what we're trying to do in the first place, which is get these small businesses up and off the ground so that they can employ people, so that they can continue the type of innovation that's really essential for the future of the U.S., for all of our futures, for our children's futures, for everyone's futures. We talked with a member of the board of directors of one of the major universities in the state of New York who has one of these so-called incubation centers at their location, and in sworn testimony, that very senior person on the board of directors stated that his little incubator center had never created a new job, in spite of the fact that millions of dollars of New York and federal tax dollars had gone into trying to promote small businesses. Clearly, there's something wrong, and the question we asked at ICM is, where is that money going?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a while back you used the term probable cause to believe. Is that a technical term? I know it is, actually, but can you take some time to explain what that means, probable cause to believe, for the listeners?
Sure, and it's a really important term. And I know this is a little technical for the listeners, but it's really important when you start talking about large cases involving fraud, abuse, and corruption like this. In criminal law, we use the term to mean that you have enough evidence to indicate that a crime may actually have been committed by someone. This is really, really important in the case of demodulation because of the preponderance or amount of evidence indicating that the federal government, New York State officials, universities, and private companies may have violated both federal and state laws, The demodulation case is supported by a huge computerized library of evidence supporting the allegation of widespread corruption. Thus, we have probable cause to believe that major fraud, waste, and abuse is occurring today involving millions of dollars of misappropriated grant funds being funded by taxpayers like you and I.
Okay, so you've done this exhaustive investigation and you've put together this comprehensive report, this computerized report, this library of evidence that's been created. Who has this information now and what are they doing with it? What steps are we going to take forward with this?
Now you're really getting at the core of what we try to do in the ICM. And it really becomes interesting in all of these cases. For example, in demodulation, our investigation reveals that they, meaning the small business owners involved, reported their belief that felonies were being committed to virtually every law enforcement authority in the federal government and in New York State. Demodulation provided law enforcement with more than enough evidence to demonstrate probable cause, the same thing that we talked about a second ago, but no one ever conducted any meaningful investigation. This is very significant because sworn law enforcement officials, when presented with evidence that felonious crimes are being committed, they're absolutely obligated to act within their duty and authority to investigate. They must investigate. If they don't investigate and they intentionally look the other way, they can be guilty of what's called misprision. Misprision is a felony. It means that you purposely didn't do your job as a sworn law enforcement official. What we're seeing in the state of New York, and in the case of demodulation, is law enforcement failing to do its job or going in and looking at only limited aspects of a much bigger problem in order to politically control outcomes. This is what we call in the business of fraud, waste, and abuse, containment. In other words, you keep the big corruption going, but you try and make the people feel comfortable by showing them little examples of, you know, contained enforcement. This is happens all of the time. I think the cases of Mr. Hevesy in New York and Mr. Brody are two very classic examples of this type of containment. Even though the Justice Department is fully aware that there is much larger corruption taking place, they only take off a little teensy-weensy bite of a sandwich. And they chew on that sandwich, and it's basically an attempt to make the people believe that they're really doing their job. Now, you've got to understand that when corruption becomes the type of thing it is in New York State, for example, so large, so invested, so deeply embedded in the structure of the system, that if one were really to do a thorough investigation of corruption in New York State, the state would probably go out of business based on what we found in the case of demodulation. It is not a good picture.
So who's investigating this now? I think what you said about containment too could also apply on the war on drugs. You see a lot of that going on. What's the Inspector General doing, or the Attorney General of New York? Have they been involved in this? Do you think that the federal government's intentionally trying to cover things up?
Absolutely. And the stakes are very, very high in the type of shell game that's being played by officials. We've had many examples like the Moreland Commission. We've had the Brody and Hevesy scandals. We've had a lot going on in New York, and it's just the tip of a huge iceberg. And to give you some examples of how big this case really is, let me talk for a minute about some of the other things that we found as we're going through our investigation of demodulation. I think the listeners will find this very interesting. We found that demodulation is not only an example of massive grant fraud, in New York, but there are some other issues that are critical to the national security of the United States itself. In the case of demodulation, we found that the U.S. intelligence community and defense community and their contracted agents engaged in unlawful domestic intelligence collection activities against demodulation. In other words, they liked demodulation's technology so much that they were willing to steal it and use state secret authority or the ability to classify information to secretly develop the technology that they stole from a small business. And by the way, these are American citizens. These are Americans just like you and I, where the government came in and took their technology and basically put them out of business. It's not a pretty picture. Demodulation patented and developed a very special technology. It was called MicroWire. MicroWire can be surreptitiously implanted into virtually any object without you being able to see it, without detection. Using MicroWire, you can electronically track the location of an object, even at great distances, like satellites. Very, very useful technology. In government jargon, the technology is called dual use, meaning that the MicroWire has both national security as well as commercial applications. So it has value for commercial products, but it's also very valuable to the intelligence community and the defense community, the Department of Defense. While demodulation didn't realize that the intelligence community was basically milking them of their trade secrets and secretly developing the technology behind their back, this went on for years, where demodulation did not realize that the powers and forces of the U.S. government were working to take their trade secrets in order to optimize, to make it work very, very well, to optimize the use of their technology in secret programs. Of course, in simple terms, the government itself was intentionally evading the Constitution and laws of the United States of America to steal what they wanted from their own American citizens. Their actions violate the National Security Act of 1947, prohibitions on domestic intelligence collection that were established with the passage of the Patriot Act, and the violation of just a huge body of federal and New York state law. And again, I want to go back to the point, nobody is willing to investigate. Now, the government is supposed to be working for the people of the United States of America, not the other way around. That's one of the reasons that this case is so disturbing.
Well, I'll ask in a bit who you have approached with this case, who seems to be dragging their feet or not investigating, but first I want to clear something. You said contracted agent of the government. Does that have a special meaning, or is there something to that other than, how is that different than a normal government contract?
Yes. Again, another excellent point and question, Ryan. The intelligence community frequently turns to government contractors to engage in tasks that they do not want to be directly tied back to. I think most Americans are aware of the example where the U.S. government turned to contractors to conduct programs of enhanced interrogation of terrorist suspects. And that's been on other major news media. I think most of us are familiar with those types of things. But why contractors do the things that they do, violate laws, do these types of things that are at best shady, is because their contracts with the government are special. In other words, there are clauses in those contracts that stipulate that they are acting as agents of the U.S. government. Now, under the laws of the United States, you can't sue the government except under very special conditions, okay? It's called sovereign immunity. So the government can do anything it wants, but we as Americans cannot individually sue the government unless we can show specific fraud against a single individual. So what we have is a system that allows these contractors to engage in corruption, waste, and abuse in the absence of accountability. No one is held accountable because you can't do anything about it. And quite frankly, the major defense contractors in the United States and others are use this as a shield, basically, to engage in work that otherwise they wouldn't engage in because the threat of embarrassment or exposure would be too great.
A gold shield, they used to say. Yeah, Ed Snowden said that U.S. government is using and developing technical computer systems that are monitoring Americans. Does the demodulation case relate to the case of Edward Snowden?
They are very, very closely related. They may seem at first blush to be kind of two different things, but they are not. As you recall, Ed Snowden blew the whistle on violations of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The Fourth Amendment is about the right of every American citizen to be free of government intrusions into their private lives. In both the case of Ed Snowden and demodulation, we have the U.S. government itself violating the very same Constitution and laws that they have been sworn to uphold. Every government employee, the first day of government service, and I know because I used to be in the government for over 30 years, raises their hand, and we swear that we are going to uphold and defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America. I am here to tell you that that is not being done in the case of demodulation. Very disturbing, because so much in our government and the honesty of our government really depends, in the end analysis, on the integrity of government workers. And what we're seeing are very, very serious violations of integrity. In spite of repeatedly reporting the problems they were finding to the government, this is demodulation, the government just acted like the proverbial ostrich, okay, that buries his head in the sand, hoping that the problems that they see and know exist go away. Well, very seldom do problems go away by themselves. Throughout the entire demodulation case, our investigation shows that public officials at all levels of our government, instead of vigorously prosecuting the law, have chosen a policy, back to this policy that we talked about, of containment, by refusing to investigate, you know, massive corruption in favor of small, isolated cases where the political outcomes can be carefully controlled. There's also another issue at play in the case of demodulation that strikes at the heart of America as a sovereign nation and a republican democracy, where citizens are in control of their own government. Now, this is a highly charged political issue involving the relationship between the United States and the State of Israel. On the one side of this very, very polarized debate, we have the defenders of Israel who believe that the United States and the world owe a moral debt to the Israeli people, largely in recompense for the terrible things that happened during the World War II period. On the other side of the political spectrum, we have those that look at the State of Israel as just another nation of the world, a nation that has its own destiny. Now, I don't want to enter into the politically charged debate, but the truth is, at the bottom line, is that the United States has laws that relate to foreign and industrial sabotage by other countries. In the case of the U.S. and Israel, the Jonathan Pollard case may be a really good example. In fact, I'll talk a little bit, hopefully give me a chance to talk about some things that happened at Picatinny Arsenal right there in your backyard that are directly related to what I'm talking about here. But Jonathan Pollard was a civilian intelligence agent that sold U.S. classified secrets to Israel in the 1970s and the 1980s. He's still in prison, but there's a very, very strong ongoing political debate about whether or not to release Jonathan Pollard because of our close alliance to Israel. What we've uncovered is evidence in the demodulation case to support allegations that the state of Israel was actually engaged in foreign and industrial sabotage. As you know, the FBI has already reported that the third most active intelligence group against the United States is, in fact, the state of Israel. Like other countries, Israel saw the value of the microwire technology for defense and military purposes, and the evidence paints the picture that Israel and several Israeli companies were involved in unlawful attempts to acquire and apply the microwire technology for their own military uses.
Yeah, I've always found it fascinating that they want to have amnesty for Jonathan Pollard, and yet Mordecai Vanunu, another whistleblower, lands in jail, and there's no cry for him. But going back to this allegation, it's pretty serious about the spying and stealing technology. This might be a softball because I know there are a lot of examples of this, but could you give some type of specific examples of that behavior?
Sure. Yeah, happy to. Well, let me give you one of many examples. The whole case of demodulation is littered with, you know, these indicators and warnings that, you know, there are foreign espionage and industrial espionage factors at play. But our investigation, for example, and this involves Picatinny right in your backyard, revealed that two 150-millimeter howitzer shells and detonators, the things that make them go boom, were stolen from Picatinny Arsenal in 2007. The theft of the munitions from a U.S. government reservation like Picatinny was allegedly masterminded by a U.S. Army official in collusion with a U.S. government contracted agent. The type of folks that we talked about before have special contracts with the U.S. government. Our inquiry shows probable cause to believe that the contracted agent involved in the theft may have actually been an unregistered agent of the State of Israel. The purpose of the theft appears to relate to the application of demodulation's microwire technology for Israeli military purposes. The U.S. Army official who allegedly masterminded the theft is a cleared employee, and get this, he still works at Picatinny Arsenal. Demodulation attorneys have presented the U.S. government with a subpoena to compel the sworn testimony of this U.S. Army official. But guess what? The government is refusing the subpoena. Amazing. That's why this case is really, really different from other cases. There are some very obvious things going on here that simply are not right. We've reported these, all of these, and a whole bunch of other significant irregularities to federal law enforcement, including the FBI, but there's no evidence at all that they're investigating. The question is, why not?
Well, I think it's like containment, like you said, but what happens next?
Well,
if we've exhausted all these resources and nobody seems to be investigating, what are there any judges taking the case, or what should we do next?
That's an interesting thing. There are two civil actions involved in the demodulation case, both taking place, one in the state of New Jersey and one in the Federal District Court of Claims in Washington, D.C., but those are civil actions. What we're talking about and what ICM does is we look at fundamental violations of law. And while civil actions take care of, you know, the money issues and that sort of thing, what takes care of the system itself? What, for example, do we have when we have a system where the laws of the land are not the same for all citizens? What do we have? And we have a very dangerous situation that affects the liberty of every man, woman, child in America. That's what we have. So we have taken the following action since we ran out of anybody else to write to. I wrote to Michael Horowitz, who is the Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Justice. And I told Mr. Horowitz that the entire demodulation matter really is of the utmost importance to the common defense and security of our country. And in the letter, I shared our concern that the failure to investigate the large-scale corruption reported to the Department of Justice already, we've already been to the FBI, and other federal law enforcement authorities, may be the result of corruption within the Department of Justice itself. So if the Department of Justice itself is corrupt, of course it's not a surprise that they're not investigating corruption in their own ranks. It happens all of the time. It's one of the things that we constantly have to guard against in our systems to make sure that we keep the liberties and the rights and the freedoms of all Americans. And if we don't do that, we're headed for trouble. We've asked Mr. Horowitz to conduct an independent and comprehensive investigation of the entire demodulation matter. And I wrote that letter to Mr. Horowitz on February 6th, and we haven't received a response from Mr. Horowitz yet, but we'll be happy to let you know the outcome.
Well, I know the mass media rarely tackles anything this complicated. They seem to deal in sound bites, but have you gone to any written press or gotten media attention for this story?
Yeah, there was a good piece done by Fox News and Eric Schon on this case. It's very telling. It speaks to both the case of demodulation and my experience with the U.S. government in basically this, what I call the ostrich syndrome, where when they're confronted with something too difficult for them to handle, that they can't put the right political spin on it, they basically do nothing. They absolutely do nothing. You write to every official in the government, and you're very lucky to have any type of response from government officials. For example, demodulation in our case and in the third case that I talked about, there were literally hundreds of letters written to officials throughout the government, 99% of which no one ever responded to. It's really interesting when you look at the lack of responsiveness Americans receive from their own government. They're supposed to be working for us, and yet when you report serious problems, serious crimes, these things happen. For example, I took a visit, actually, to do this investigation. I went to the Southern District of New York, and I went to the Attorney General, both Attorney Generals, in Newark, New Jersey. And you know what? I got thrown out. They said, we're not going to talk to you. Go away. Don't bother us. And don't ever come back to this office again. Now, there's something wrong with the story where an American citizen identifies massive corruption and then tries to report it, and these agencies turn you away at the door.
I mean, did they have an explanation for why?
No, they said I didn't send them an email first before I showed up. I mean, that's why I say I think things, in our country, things are like a pendulum. You know, we swing one way and we swing the other. I think the pendulum has gone way too far in one direction here. And I think it needs some attention of the American people to help get the momentum moving in the other direction. In other words, to find ways to make sure that our government is responsive to the people, that the government does not become the government to meet its own ends, but rather to meet the ends of the Constitution, the laws of the land, and people, individual, ordinary people like you and me. And I think we've forgotten something. And I think something needs to happen. And that's why we wrote to Inspector General Horowitz, and we certainly hope that they do their job, because this is an issue of critical importance.
Well, in both these cases that you mentioned, it also discourages people, inventors and people researching and discovering things from applying for patents within the U.S. or opening their small business, especially in New York, maybe in America in general, and providing these jobs, because they really can't trust that it won't just be stolen from them and outsourced to a large corporation that already exists, or possibly to a foreign corporation like the Israelis in this case. Why would they stay here?
Absolutely, Ryan. And I couldn't agree more. I think that's really the essence of this one, is what is the impact of this behavior trying to, I guess, replace small businesses with large corporate interests. And I think there's a really good recent example of things that are happening right now within the area of patents, people re-looking at issues involved with patents. And there may be the danger that what we're doing is we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, small businesses without patent protection and something that's enforced will have no motivation whatsoever to do the types of innovation that are critical to the national defense of this country and to our economic safety. This is a competitive world, and my goodness, we need the opportunity to encourage young people to come forward and to innovate, innovate, innovate. That is our only way to keep on top of a global economy. Things have changed. We absolutely need to innovate.
And so many new technologies, especially with computers, have come from the grassroots, people who dropped out of college even, like Bill Gates, or the founders of Facebook, etc. New innovations are coming from everywhere, but they need startup capital, and usually they need the support of universities. For MicroWire, for example, if they're, some component of this wire, I don't want to explain how it's made or anything, but uses ceramics or metals or something that's specialized, you're going to want a university that already has research in that to help physically make it once you have the knowledge behind it, but they won't be able to trust them with the secrets, because they'll just turn around, sell them to some third party, and run away with everything. And you're not only affecting the company and their intellectual property rights, but it's a significant job loss as well for the area where it could have been produced.
I think that's a great summary. And I think one of the big problems here is that there's a fundamental conflict between academia or universities and what's done in the private sector. And with universities, they like to share ideas. Research is all about, you know, sharing ideas. But in industry, it's a different rule. It's a rule where you want to maintain critical information that's necessary for you to maintain a competitive edge in the marketplace. So you have two different cultures at odds. What makes it worse is we establish most of these so-called incubator centers at where? Universities. Universities, you know, are the spot of choice because they also have scientists and engineers. However, it's really important to recognize that the culture and the motivation for a university professor is quite different than it is for a small business entrepreneur who's trying to innovate and commercialize technology. So what we end up doing is we create competitors. Right now, the government funds huge, huge grants, all sorts of money going to universities throughout the nation, and that money is basically intended to incubate small businesses, but there's a tremendous motivation to divert that money, as we're seeing in the case of demodulation, to other things. Universities are among the most cash-strapped organizations on the planet. They don't have enough money, okay? And so what they're going to do is look for every opportunity possible to support their basic institution. And frequently, that conflicts with what you're trying to do when you start up a small business, when you look for venture capital, when you're trying to maintain protection of your trade secrets and your patents.
Well, they're in a convenient position as a middleman, really, when they're getting the trade secrets and patents, because the nature of you have to share it with them to continue further the research, and you also, to apply for the grant money and qualify for it, you have to say a little bit what you're doing, or you're not going to get it. There's nothing really to prevent the university then from sort of auctioning off the secrets to other large entities, you know, for top dollar, if nobody's enforcing the patent rules.
No, it isn't. In fact, what happens in New York, let's use New York for example, we have organizations called NYSTAR and the State University of New York's Research Fund, which is about $1 billion a year operation. It takes in $1 billion of taxpayer dollars, and it determines which are the best, you know, projects to work on. And they allow the universities to come in and, you know, compete for that money. Sometimes people just totally bypass the process and, you know, give grant money to other people, which is, you know, fraudulent activity. So you have a lot of things going on where the money is flowing directly to the university. And my goodness, when we go, you know, ask under sworn testimony from a very high level person on the board of one of these universities, one of the biggest universities in New York, by the way, and they tell you, golly gee whiz, we haven't created one job with it. Again, I go back to what we discussed earlier. Hold it just a second here. Where did the money go? And I think that's the question that New Yorkers need to start asking of Governor Cuomo and other leaders in the state of New York. Where is the money going? If it is not going for its intended purposes, then what is it being used for? And have the people approved it?
Well, it seems like it would go into the research and development of the established corporations, and they're just going to ignore any startups or small businesses like Demodulation.
Sure.
The establishment already have a grip within the systems, you know what I mean? That's probably where the money's going. And there's also a huge room for insider trading as well. If any of these are, you know, publicly traded companies, they end up shifting the grant money toward, if there's a breakthrough kind of technology like this, sort of a hidden, you know, like microwire is definitely a dual use, definitely worth lots of money, they can prepare and invest ahead of time, it seems like.
Yeah, they sure can. I think that's exactly what's happening in the case of Demodulation. What's happening is these incubator centers at universities are being used to basically steal the technology from small businesses. That technology is put into one of the major centers, like the Photonics Center, all sorts of different centers across the state of New York. It's being thrown in there and goes to basically the highest bidders. They have companies, very large companies around these centers that basically use the technology that was stolen in the first place by the university to subsidize their own research and development. Now, in our system, companies are supposed to pay for their own research and development. The question now becomes for the citizens of New York, golly gee whiz, should we be subsidizing a large corporation like IBM, Corning, Glassworks, Texas Instruments? Should we really be subsidizing the research and development necessary to commercialize technology? And the system hasn't worked that way before. And it's awfully expensive, and it means higher profits for corporate pockets. But the real question is that in the best interest of the citizens of this country and the citizens of the state of New York? That's the question. And that's the question that must be answered by senior officials in the state of New York.
It also keeps the businesses from diversifying and allows the sort of core group to remain their economic hegemony the way it is. Now, this case has gone on for years, is that correct?
Yeah, it started really back in the fall of the former Soviet Union. I don't know whether you're aware of this, but microwire was originally developed for use
Romania.
In biplane. It was basically used for stealth technology or to electromagnetically shield the location from radar of an aircraft. That's what microwire was intentionally intended to do. So this little company, Demodulation, went over to Romania at the end of the Cold War and started a relationship with the world's foremost scientist, Dr. Horia Shirok, in this whole area of electromagnetism and what we call amorphous metals, a technical term that we don't really need to get into here. But they established a relationship. What they didn't know is that the U.S. intelligence community, after the fall of the former Soviet Union, was already there. And so they were acquiring the technology, okay, clandestinely. And Demodulation acquired the technology legally. In other words, they wrote a license and they followed international rules and laws and all that sort of stuff to commercialize the technology. They did not realize at that time that the government was secretly developing the technology behind their backs. Now, what the real problem here is, you know, everybody spies on everybody else, Ryan. We all know that. We're all thick boys and girls. We're aware of that. But when you put a U.S. citizen in the middle of such a thing and then purposely work to compete with him using state secret classification authority, you've got a whole different ballgame. That's what we call the violation of the Constitution. Some very important parts of the Constitution. One is Article 1, which is the Patents and Copyright Clause of the Constitution. One is the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which says, hey, you know, this is my stuff. It's private. It's mine. It's owned by me. There's no room for the government without a warrant to come in and search and seize my trade secrets as a company, an American company. The third issue is Amendment 5, which is the Takings Clause. The Constitution states in Amendment 5 that you cannot seize the property of a U.S. citizen without proper compensation. And that's exactly what's happening, not only to Demodulation, but thousands and thousands of other companies that are facing unfair competition by the U.S. government itself. Certainly a situation that requires the careful thought of every American citizen and our leadership. Very, very important to get this problem fixed.
Absolutely. And now, you were talking about the governor in New York. I don't know if you can. I don't want to get into anything in the case that would hurt the case. I don't want to reveal any information that might be sensitive. But if you can speak to how is the governor involved? It seems to be mostly federal grant money going to a university. I guess is he involved in that process? I'm not sure how that relates to the allocation of money to schools or anything.
Right. Well, I think as all governors, the governor, Governor Cuomo, is sitting upon the top of a system that he is responsible for. So when we see things like the Demodulation case, we immediately ask the question, where is the governor? We look to our governors to help us, to lead us, to make sure that systems are operating properly in a way that reflects the needs of the people and the Constitution and laws of the United States. What we found in the Demodulation case is a massive, massive violation of federal law, New York state law, that is directly impacting the people of New York State. Now, the question is, what actions have we seen to clean this mess up and to try and fix it? There's a lot of talk today about integrity and commissions, and there's also a lot of evidence showing that many of these commissions, when they got out of control, so to speak, really started looking at the matter, were abolished, stopped, not allowed to do their jobs, all that sort of thing. I think Governor Cuomo has a responsibility to the taxpayers of the state of New York and the federal taxpayer to make sure that he's running a clean show. And it's time to get in there and take a look at these things, do the things that are necessary to basically get the system back on track. And that's where I'll end on Governor Cuomo right now. There is a great deal of other evidence in this case that we are currently working with, but for now, I think that's the major issue. Are people doing their jobs? And if they're not doing their jobs, it's up to us as citizens to make sure they do.
Absolutely. I mean, this case is very complicated, and we could talk about it forever and ever, but I think we'll close things up for now and move on to some other things. But Dr. Nacio, I want to tell you that we'll definitely have you back again. I do want to delve into the case some more, but I appreciate your time. And I'd also like to mention to the audience that ICM, this nonprofit charitable organization we've been talking about, if you'd like to donate, or if you're one of the many victims of government corruption and you'd like to contact ICM, then please do so. And I really appreciate your time. And I'll have the web address up in the blog for everybody if you want to donate or if you need their help and the protection. It's very important that we have these kind of organizations. I know a lot of nonprofit organizations and NGOs and et cetera aren't what they say, but this one is legit. I vetted and approved it. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.